Hello! Welcome to Faithfully Memphis. My name is Emily Austin, and I am with the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee. Each week we come here at our crosstown radio home, WYXR 91.7 FM, to have conversations that we think matter about what it means to be a person of faith living in the year 2023 in America, in a world that is kind of a big, beautiful, ugly mess a lot of the time. And this week, I'm really, really excited to have back on our show Mark Hackett, who originally came on Faithfully Memphis. I think it would have been like late 2020 or it may have been late 2021. There, you know, it's that mishmash of time where, it was everything all at once of the pandemic era. But Mark came on our show and spoke with Bishop Phoebe about his work with Operation Broken Silence, which is his nonprofit that he founded that offers support and advocacy towards Sudan and a lot of the chaos but beautiful country that is Sudan. And ever since then, I think that I invited him on the show just to learn about that work that he was doing with Operation Broken, or still does with Operation Broken Silence. But also I know him from our Christian community here in Memphis, and he was doing a lot of just interrogative work in figuring out how his role as a Christian was intersecting in his public persona. And the conversation, I commend that to you. Please go back and listen to it. And ever since then, I've been like, I got to get Mark back on the show. So, hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm glad it's early morning, but we have coffee and we have water, and
yes.
I'm really glad to be spending the next little bit just chatting.
Yeah, this is going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So since we last talked, I've learned a little bit more about the writing you're doing, the podcasting that you're doing. Will you tell us a little bit about your newsletter and your blog and your podcast and how that was born out of, you know, this, is there a direct correlation between Operation Broken Silence and that work, or are they two just kind of things that live in your mind and you needed to see to fruition?
Yeah, I think it's probably both. So, yeah. In my time in Sudan, I have spent quite a bit of time in Sudanese churches when I'm over there, which, mm-hmm. Is pretty different than here. And, growing up in the Bible Belt, I just, like a lot of people who grew up in the Bible Belt, just kind of assumed this was the way church was done.
Faith
was done. And as I started, I guess, visiting Sudan, gosh, it's been about 11 years now. Mm. I would say all the way back then, I started having questions about how we do faith here in the U.S. because I saw a lot of things the Sudanese church was doing in a war setting. Mm-hmm. That was having tremendous positive impact in their community, helping people in very tangible ways. And, coming back from those trips to here, seeing some of that, activity lacking and willingness to, interrogate things that we believed are always true, mm-hmm. to see some of that lacking here as well. I think a lot of Christians living in our country, the last 7 or 8 years have been a lot. I think, in that time, I like to use the word apocalypse in like the biblical sense of like an unveiling of, we've really seen an unveiling of some of the rot in our institutions. That mm-hmm. includes some of our churches.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
I would say these two things came together of seeing a church in a war setting that was really offering up the best of what we see in the early church in scripture, but also seeing some of the chaos here in the U.S. and the church world and its relation to politics and our culture.
Yeah.
And so I just started, I've always been a writer. Like that's how I process. And I just, at some point the last few years, just started hitting publish just to see what would happen. And kind of discovered like, oh, there's a lot of people who are asking these questions too.
Ken, I want to go back to what you were saying about the church in Sudan and by the church, I always, when I say that, I mean like the big C church and the way that they were practicing their faith. Can you tell me a little bit, like maybe offer some examples of like what you were seeing about the way that they were interfacing with their faith within that cultural context that spoke to you and made you take those lessons back home?
Yeah. So I come out of an evangelical, an American evangelical background, and that's historically that's been a world that's very triumphalist and like, we're always moving forward, know, and,
there's a lot of, the language that I often hear is one of, victory.
Yes.
And there's a lot of, it's a lot of political war-like jargon, and that you just kind of, at least the way that I grew up, I kind of just took that at face value. It's like, okay, well, this is what we are.
I hear that. I've seen a lot of that. But you know, in the Sudanese church, I think a lot of this has to do with the war in Sudan. There is a much more willingness to kind of sit in the mess and mourn and be somber, that I think we lack that here, think in a lot of cases. And so when something does, you know, something bad happens in a church or it just feels like church isn't working, like we tend to sweep things under the rug to a certain degree and just say, oh, we keep going. And in a lot of Sudanese churches, they'll say, no, we need to sit in this at least for a minute and process what this means for us and figure out together where we're supposed to go. So that's, I would say that's probably the biggest difference I've noticed. And that really has caused me to question some things.
And so you've always been a writer and you've always been someone who processes things by getting them out there. I identify that with that a lot. I just want to just, you know, create something and then push it out.
Yeah.
so then you started writing and tell me a little bit about that process and what that has looked like since you kind of came out in that way where you're being very transparent about what you're thinking.
So I mean, I originally started kind of the I guess you'd say like church deconstruction route, and really early on learned like, I'm not questioning like if Jesus is Lord or anything. I'm just questioning like everything we do in the church. Like, is this really what we're supposed to be? Are some of these things really what we're supposed to be focused on? And so I've written a lot about church culture and you know, I have a lot of concerns about some of our patriarchal systems in certain parts of American Christianity. You know, kind of a fragility that comes with the, I guess, a cultural certainty that we have in a lot of churches that we confuse for theological certainty. I started questioning just a lot of church culture stuff. And I'd say over the past probably year, that's shifted more into exploring other faith traditions, exploring biblical scholarship, you know, reading some church historians, you know, people who have a much more, I would say, objective view on kind of where we are and how we got here. And so I've really, I would say, have gone down that road. So like, I the past 2 months I've been looking at Christian atonement theory, which
on your podcast is Extra Words.
Yes.
Just did a wonderful interview about atonement theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I never knew that there, I mean, I guess I could have assumed, but yeah. I never knew that there was such a, like, very, there's like several different kinds, interpretations of it.
Yeah.
And it's like always, it's a word that we hear a lot growing up in the church and that we still, you know, it's a pretty, you know, solid, you know, lens mm-hmm. to interpret things with. But I didn't even know that there was discussion around it.
Yeah, I think here in the U.S., you know, we've been taught like Jesus died for your sins, right? Yeah.
Like, well, what does that even mean? Exactly. How did that how does that work out? Like, yeah. like tell me about the magic around that.
Yeah, and you know, but Christians of good faith have been asking that question of like, well, what does this actually mean for 2,000 years now? And surprise, not everyone's agreed on it.
Yeah,
on what that means and how all that works. And I would say 10 years ago asking that question and going down that rabbit hole would have caused me a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
But now I feel in a place like, oh, this is actually really good because this means that there's some mystery here, and to a certain degree I'm never going to understand how this fully works, and there's actually a lot of comfort that can come with that of understanding like, hey, I'm actually not supposed to know every little detail of how our salvation plays out.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank goodness, because otherwise I don't know what the point of all of this, you know, faith Christian work would be if we, you know, just woke up tomorrow and there was some clear cut way to like live and mm-hmm. to be and get really in the last, certainly throughout the, you know, just throughout a faith life in general, we're constant and throughout the history of people searching for what it is that they can hang their hat on. I feel like interrogation is always something that, that we have to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in the last, maybe decade or so, and especially, you know, we're fellow millennials, you know, we were born in a world that while it wasn't, you know, very long ago, it's very dissimilar to the world that we live in right now.
Yes.
And I think that the skill set and the things that were part of our formation and our formative years are, you know, anyway, I'm digressing in a major way. I guess what I'm trying to say is that we constantly have to be asking those questions.
Mm-hmm.
That right before we went on the air, we were talking about how that is what I think gives this faithful life so much color and so much meaning.
It's
just constantly asking the questions and placing ourselves within this moment,
mm-hmm.
this moment that we're living in right now. And another thing we were talking about before the show is that this moment is a lot.
Yes, it is a lot.
Yeah. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have you come back on the show is that, you know, you and I both, we have expressed a lot of just frustration and not just frustration, but I think kind of that anguished cry of how long, Lord, with a lot of the things that we're seeing here in Tennessee at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's May of 2023 guns are still a thing here in the United States, but certainly we've seen a lot of people that we are close with fall victim to that violence. So we're living in that cultural moment. We're also living in a cultural moment where, there's a lot coming down the pike in 2024.
Yeah.
and then, when I started hearing the news about what was happening in Sudan, I thought to myself, man, Mark, I mean, how do you balance all that? Can, for folks who might not be 100% aware of the current moment of what's going on in Sudan, can you give a little background about like sort of the tumult that we've been seeing in the last month or so?
Yeah, so I'll try to move through this quick because we could talk about this for hours.
No, please go ahead. I think it's important.
Yeah, so so Sudan, the past, 30, 35 years has been under the rule of a pretty brutal military regime. And in 2019, the Sudanese people rose up and started overthrowing parts of that regime in peaceful protest. Mm-hmm. So Sudan's longtime dictator, Omar al-Bashir, was forced out. He's actually imprisoned. He's also indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and genocide in Sudan. So not the best guy, right?
Yeah.
But what has happened since then is, you know, there's been a few processes in place for Sudan to move away from military rule towards civilian government, which if you walk just about anywhere in Sudan, any town, any city, like that's what people want.
Yeah.
They're kind of done with military rule.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Relate.
Yeah. And so in October 2021, there was a transitional civilian government that was overthrown by the military. So the military took back over. Mm-hmm. And there were two generals who led that coup. One of them was the general of the official army, which is like Sudan's, you know, military, like every country has. And the other general was overseeing a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces.
Yeah.
And that is essentially a private army. It is accountable to no one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's anywhere, you know, some estimates say the RSF has up to 100,000 troops.
Yeah.
So this is like a thing, right? And so since the coup in October 2021, these two generals have increasingly butted heads on how things should proceed in Sudan. And on we have actually been warning for months that this was heading towards a pretty explosive conflict. And so on April 15th, we're still not sure exactly what happened, but army troops and RSF paramilitary started shooting at each other in certain parts of the country. And that quickly spread all over the country. And so we have a situation now where essentially two men who want power and who have a lot of guns are trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
And 38 million Sudanese are kind of caught in the crossfire right now.
Yeah.
So previous wars in Sudan have been fought over ideology, ethnicity, religion. This war is zero sum power.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. And I've talked a lot with our Sudanese partners the last few weeks, obviously, and they have all told me that this is the dumbest thing they've ever seen happen and most destructive thing. Khartoum, the capital, is literally a open war zone right now.
Wow.
Where you have, you know, these different government factions are fighting it out in neighborhoods, hospitals are being hit. I mean, it is, by any objective standard, this is like a complete security meltdown and governmental catastrophe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. We'll just sit with that for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
How do you process all of it? I mean, not how do you process all of it well, because I don't know that any of us like are equipped with those answers. How do you live in that world?
Yeah.
And occupying that space and working really hard to support the good work of the people of Sudan, and also occupying this space in Memphis, Tennessee, this world of Mark Hackett.
Yeah. Well, I don't always process or balance these things well because it is a lot. I think I try to really sit in these things with people. So a lot of my job the past, I guess, month has really just been sitting with our Sudanese partners and just listening and hearing their frustration, hearing their anger, and not even I mean, we're not even talking about a path forward right now. There's things we're doing to help move people to safer locations. And, you know, there are some emergency things we're doing. But a lot of my job has just been listening to folks vent.
Yeah, it almost sounds like pastoral.
Yeah.
You know, not to say, I mean, because you're not a cleric. I mean, neither of us are ordained.
Yeah.
But it's that sort of just pastoral role where you sit with people in their pain.
Yeah, because I think in these moments, whether it's over in Sudan right now or a lot of us here in Tennessee, where we've had a lot of, I think, disappointment with our state government lately, I think in those moments, people don't want change. They also want to be seen and heard.
Yeah.
And so taking a few minutes before you even talk about a solution or a way forward and just sitting in the mess. Again, like the Sudanese are very good at doing this.
Yeah. They've been sitting in it for a while.
Yeah. That, you know, in those moments of frustration and silence, that's also moments where hope is found again, where we are reminded that we are people who believe in the resurrection. And if the resurrection is true, I think it is, then there's always reason to hope.
Yeah.
It might take us a few extra moments to get back to that.
Yeah.
But it's really sitting in community with people where you find your way back to that. And then it might just be small steps, but that's when steps forward start to be found again. Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about resurrection and what you, when you use that term, what you mean, because it's, you know, as we discussed, you know, we're always interrogating those terms and we're always thinking about, well, what do we mean by resurrection? And I think that it's so interesting to me what comes with that for lots of different Christians and different people. From what does that mean for you?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it means that
we wouldn't be able to keep this archive going without your support. Donate online today at WYSR.org.
I do a pretty good job of speaking to how Jesus changes us as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
I might disagree with some of the cultural changes that are that are seen in that world. And that's fine.
You do disagree, and you do it so gently, and that's what I love that's what I love about the way you carry yourself, Mark.
I appreciate that. But if we really believe that Jesus overcame death itself, then that means everything is on the table now, right? That means our governments can change, our cultures can change, our societies can change for the better. I think, you know, here in the U.S., we're so hyper-individualized. We think, like, the story of Jesus and the resurrection is a story of individual salvation.
Yeah.
And I think when you, you know, kind of speaking broadly of the New Testament, what we really see is like Jesus' life, death, and resurrection is all about bringing heaven to earth, right?
Yeah.
It's not, we're supposed to have like one eye cut toward heaven and this world's kind of lost and we're just waiting to get out of here.
It's not a reward for a life well lived.
No, it's not. And, but if we really believe that, and I do, that means that we can change things and we are supposed to change things for the better. It doesn't mean all the change we want is going to happen overnight or that it's going to be easy or that there's not going to be moments of despair. But it does mean that in these, I would say, darker moments that we're in, that's actually when hope makes the most sense. Because not only do we need it, but, you know, we also saw Jesus, you know, in scripture leading up to his death, dealing with a lot of anxiety, a lot of questions. Yeah. And so our Savior relates to these moments in our own lives in a very real, visceral way.
And also relating and really trying to minister to the people around him while he was dealing with that anxiety and that knowledge that things are going to get real bad before they get better.
Yeah.
Ministering to, you know, the folks who already had their hand in a pile, his disciples, and but also the people around him. And just, I think that that's a really... I'm really grateful that you brought that up, because it is it's good to have a reminder that our Jesus is incarnational.
Yes.
He was a person.
Yeah.
And he went through it.
Yeah.
But he was also God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, in our kind of, I shouldn't say logical world, because there seems to be a lot of illogical things happening right now. But I mean, if you look at Christianity from the outside in, like, it's weird, right? Like we believe in a God man born of a virgin who died and overcame death itself. Like, that's, I'm a Christian. I'm willing to say, like, that's not normal. Like, that's weird.
It's a lot. It's a hard sell.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm just kind of like, you know, just love God, love your neighbor. Yeah. It's like, just do you.
Yeah. And I think that's really where it boils down. What we really need right now is, I think in like a lot of our, like I'm like a super hardcore institutionalist. So I believe in the power of institutions to change things for good. I also understand that when institutions are not well tended to, they can do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think to like so many churches and their doctrinal statements have these views that aren't wrong, like saying Jesus died and came to life again. Like, I believe that. That's not wrong. But Jesus's greatest commandment was love God, love your neighbor. And that is in very few churches' doctrinal statements.
I think that's
part of our challenge is like people might say, oh, you know, a doctrinal statement, it's something we post on our websites and stuff. But it's like, no, like people read this stuff and we build our cultures around these things. And if what Jesus said was most important is not in those statements, that is going to change the way we do things, and maybe not for the best.
Well, I mean, I think also in listening to the most recent episode of your podcast, we focus so much on, and by we, I mean the Big C Church and the kind of traditions. And this is, it's an easy thing to do when you grow up in the American church. It's easy to focus on that atonement, that moment of crucifixion and resurrection, but we think about, you know, Jesus's miracles, and we think about his earthly ministry, but atonement is great, but let's look at that, those 33 years before the cross. Let's think about who Jesus was and what he said, and not just the things he said, but the things that he did. And he was going around loving unlovable people, quote unquote unlovable people. He was going around speaking truth to power. He was not making friends with the people that we would say you want to make friends with when you're trying to develop a coalition. Let's think about that life of Christ and write that into who we are as people. What does it mean to you, Mark, to absorb what's going on in the world and a lot of the pain and a lot of the problems that we're faced with every day, and then be a presence for people who need you? We talked a little bit about just being in that space and being a listener and occupying pain with people, and how transformative that can be for ourselves and for people who are going through it. But what else do you have in your toolkit? What are some other, you know, strategies that you have for just being a Christian in a good faith way?
Yeah, I think at least now what I'm trying to do is just focusing on things that I can change and control.
Yeah.
And like, I can't fix gun violence in this country, right? Like, no individual person can do that. I also can't fix everything in Sudan, and frankly, it's not my job to. that's our Sudanese partner's job. But I think, you know, and as we sit with people in their moments of pain and suffering, needs, very tangible needs are often expressed. Mm-hmm. You know, they might be short-term needs. I think really focusing on those and kind of being in the moment and saying, okay, what can we change like right here, right now? That's, you know, do I have a friend who, you know, owns several guns who's kind of starting to question like, hey, is this something I want to be participating in? Yeah. Considering kind of where our country is, like, you know, instead of judging that person, going to them and actually having a conversation and saying like, you know, like, why are you considering this now? And, you know, what's, you know, and trying to help them find a way forward. Cause I, you know, I think oftentimes we, you know, in a, I guess, political, cultural sense in our country, we push everything into elections, which that's not necessarily like a bad thing. Like we should have good leaders and we should vote for,
and it's a tangible thing. Yeah. You know, if all else fails, for me at least, it's like, I can tell people just make sure you're registered.
Yeah.
Make sure you're registered to vote and get out there and vote, because it's something you can do.
Yeah. And, but I mean, even to a certain degree, like I shouldn't say it's an easy thing, cause you know, voter suppression and stuff like that happens in this country. But I mean, there are a lot of people like going and voting is like the easiest thing they can do. What's much harder is occupying a space with someone who, yes, is hurting, but also may be on the other side of the issue. From you. That is a much trickier, especially when there's pain and suffering involved.
Yeah.
There's often a lot of anger involved too.
Yeah.
And I think that's where like really listening and hearing people helps, because it kind of diffuses that anger.
Yeah.
And you can really get to the heart of the issue after that. So
And listening with sincerity and mm-hmm. not necessarily as a well, maybe if I'm quiet for a minute, they'll get to this point on their own. Like, listening with sincerity is something that I have found is, I consider myself a good listener, and a lot of times I'm very dismissive.
Yeah.
And I don't want to hear it anymore. Yeah. I think there's a righteous anger that, while it's righteous for me, at least, it's easy for me to just throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to folks who are at that point of questioning, but they're not where I'm at yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, righteous anger is not a bad thing, but it can definitely be expressed in destructive ways.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's something else we kind of miss in the Christian faith here in the U.S. is we think, oh, our anger is righteous, so therefore I am righteous. And it's like, maybe you want to slow down a little bit before you go down that road.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something I struggle with from time to time too. Is like, I do hit points of frustration where it's like, or either like someone's not hearing what I'm saying, and it might be because I'm not expressing it well. Like that happens too, right?
Yeah.
But where I do sometimes at that point of just like, why is this bridge not here? Like, why are you not hearing what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that it's gotten worse? Like, just the dialogue that we tend to engage with across the aisle. Do you think that, and I guess it, I think that if we look from a broad perspective at just dialogue in America, it has gotten worse and people are very polarized right now. But do you think that in the church, and within the context that you're working in, do you observe that it's getting worse, getting better? I mean, what is your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain degree that this is all localized, right? Like some, I mean, there's not many, but some churches the past several years have actually done like really well.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I would say, you know, most pastors would probably tell you the opposite of like, no, like this is not a good time to be a pastor. But I try to keep like the long arc of human history in mind as we have these conversations, because the reality is like the world is a much better place than it was even 100 years ago.
And I love that quote from Martin Luther King Jr., the long arc of history hangs on justice.
Yeah. And like we are quite literally a few years away from eliminating extreme poverty on Earth. Like that is not a small thing. That's huge. We're still going to have poverty, but extreme poverty, like the kind of poverty that like kills people daily. Yeah. Like we have almost eliminated that from the face of the Earth. Yeah. We are a few years. There was a great New York Times article about that. I think 6 or 7 months ago, they kind of broke down, you know, rise of incomes and all kinds of things all around the world and showed like, wow, we're close. And, so I try to keep things like that, at least in the back of my mind, of saying like, hey, I'm actually glad I didn't live like 600 or 700 years ago. Cause it was like,
yeah.
know, that, you know, there are some times back in history that were, I mean, it was not a good time to be.
I mean, there's
the
whole justice piece of, and maybe lack of it in the Middle Ages, but also they were just like throwing their garbage and their sewage out the window.
Yeah.
And, and I'm not, that's not a hyperbolic statement. Yeah. They were throwing it out the window into the street.
Yeah.
It was gross and awful.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of ways, I mean, even the past 100 years, I mean, not just the world, but we as a country have made progress. Yeah, there has been some backsliding lately for sure. But you know, I would say in broadly speaking in the church, we're having some very in capital C church, there are some very severe discourse issues right now.
And I observe those as well. And it's very heartening.
Yeah.
I don't think if you had told me maybe 25 years ago that we would be able to talk, I could freely talk about the things that are on my mind as a Christian, with and state the things that I hold to without necessarily being ostracized. I mean, it's you know, we're constantly, you know, watching our steps to make sure that we're gonna say the right thing. But if you had told me many years ago that I would be able to say the things that I say and be the person who I am without being, you know, whatever the evangelical version of excommunication is, shaming or, you know, purity cultured to death, I don't know that I would have believed it.
I mean, in a lot of ways there has been this really wide opening of discourse. I think the challenge is that in those in some of those evangelical spaces, you still can't have those conversations in those spaces,
because
you will get
ousted, and
you know, you might not get thrown out of a church, but people will make it to where you don't want to be there. And you know, I think there is a sense right now of, I think we were kind of talking about this before we started recording, but the future of the American church has to be more ecumenical. I mean, we are living in a culture that is, it's secularizing, but it's not secularizing away from Christianity necessarily.
Right.
It's secularizing away from a specific kind of Christendom.
Yes.
A cultural Christianity. And there are good things and bad things that are going to come with that, like most things on this planet. But
whenever you want to make a sacred cow out of anything, sacred cows are great until you start viewing them as the idol rather than.
Yeah. But, you know, I do see in some ways, like I see Anglicans and Episcopalians and Methodists like starting to talk to each other in real ways. And I think the more conservative evangelical world is largely avoiding joining in that conversation.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's not just unhelpful for them, it's also unhelpful for us.
Yeah.
You know,
well, we need as many people at the table.
Yeah.
In order, I mean, you know, just from a research standpoint, you want to have as many, you want to have as much of a diverse sample as you can get.
Yeah.
So that you can have an exhaustive view of the cultural challenges that you're trying to address and meet and the people that you're trying to serve.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, if someone is excluded from that, then by nature, it's not going to work.
Yeah. And I think, like, I mean, we're called to do that as Christians anyways, right? Like the early church was very Jewish, but it also became very Gentile quickly. Yeah. And as as more and more people came into the church, I mean, you see, I think in the New Testament, you see this issue being wrestled with of like, you know, are there boundaries to this? Yeah. Are there not? What are those boundaries?
Yeah.
And, you know, and you have sometimes things in the New Testament that sound contradictory, like Paul yearning for his people to come to Christ, but he's also yearning for everyone to come together. And yeah. like, it almost sounds like those things are against each other. I don't think they are.
Yeah.
But you know, working through, like, we're still working through that 2000 years later, right?
Yeah. yeah. We certainly are. I think that we've definitely, you know, for all the faults of, you know, institutionalized Christianity, mm-hmm. there's a lot of good stuff there that we can iterate on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not ever going to get a clear answer on. We're not going to clearly understand, like, what it is that we're hanging our hats on until we, you know, reach that fullness of time moment.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm with you. So what are you reading? What are you consuming these days? Like what's like speaking to you, Mark?
Yeah. I just finished a book, the author Zach Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Non-Toxic Masculinity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of the challenges to purity culture have mostly come from women, which is completely understandable.
Yeah.
But I don't know Zach. But after reading his book, he's really the first man I've seen step into that space and start pointing out like what he sees wrong with it.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of like, until we're all free, nobody is free. Like the idea of it's probably going to be the oppressed that say something first.
Sure.
But oppression is a tool and it's a toxic tool. And if you are exerting it, even if it's on an outside entity, it's going to hurt you eventually.
Yeah.
We want to dig out the thing that's a problem.
Yeah. But I think the interesting thing about Zach's book is that, you know, a lot of men who come out of purity culture, like who like leave that world.
Yeah.
Like that's a good thing, right? Like
yeah.
we don't want people in that space because it's unhealthy in a lot of ways. But something he really points to in the book is a lot of men who leave that don't know what they're supposed to be doing.
Right. And I feel like that's boy, is that the millennial life is like, or not millennial. I don't know why I put it in that context, but it's like, okay, I know this was wrong.
Yeah.
Now what?
Yeah. And Zach's book, and he does this throughout the book, is kind of his journey of asking that question of, he's like, well, I don't want to be passive, but how do I engage the world without, you know, being overly aggressive, and kind of all these parts of purity culture there are, you know, I think a lot of us have scars from.
Yeah.
And, you know, he doesn't arrive at a lot of like solid answers of like, this is what men should be doing. He really arrives at the answer of like, hey, like your personality and what God calls you to, means that in certain situations you're going to behave differently and you should behave differently. And there's not one way to go about doing this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we really want to have a handbook. We really want to have a listicle and like things that we need to be doing. And while there are behaviors that tend to, you know, in any kind of re-interrogation of something that we want to root out in our lives, we really want to have a playbook.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the answer to every question is, well, it depends.
I mean,
what does that look like in your life? What is, I mean, and that's where I think intersectionality becomes so important.
Yeah.
Like, how old are you? What were you raised with?
Yeah.
What is your gender identity?
Where were you born?
Where were you born? Are you a parent?
Yeah.
Are you, what's your socioeconomic class?
Yeah.
Are you partnered?
Yeah.
Who with?
Yeah.
Do you want to be?
Yeah.
Like it really depends on where you are, to, and those different, you know, extraneous things around ourselves to figure out, well, what does it look like to live a, to be a Christ-like person mm-hmm. within my context.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So that sounds like a good one.
Yeah. It's a good book.
What else? What else? You said you're listening to a lot of podcasts.
I am. Yeah. I'm kind of haven't listened to music in a little bit. I'm a big fan of the Bible for Normal People podcast. I think if you have a lot of questions about like how the Bible works, are we doing this whole Christian faith thing right? That podcast will not give you solid answers, but it does ask a lot of the questions I think we should be asking right now.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they will talk about any and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
On that show. And you never, every week, you never know what the topic's going to be about. So there's kind of an element of surprise to it. That's
okay,
really fun.
Cool.
I would say if you're struggling and with even knowing like how to ask questions about like Jesus and the Bible and our world, like they have those conversations in a very healthy, constructive way, even if they don't arrive at solutions or conclusions. So
Yeah. Cool. Well, I always appreciate getting a good recommendation from folks who are living in that media world. And is there anything that's like not necessarily from that Christian perspective that you're digging right now? You're listening to or reading or?
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything. I mean, I keep up with the news.
Yeah.
And I think, there's a growing awareness that our, I hate the term mainstream media because it's so it's such a ridiculous term, but I guess kind of our institutionalized media in this country doesn't seem to have learned the right lessons from the last 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's May 11th when we're recording this, and I mean, just Google what happened on May 10th and you're just like, what was on, prime time last night. And I'm just like, y'all, do you remember like just everything ever? Anyway.
So I wouldn't say I've read a book on this, but there are, I mean, you can poke around online, look up media criticism, things like that. And there are a lot of, I think, journalists, former journalists who right now are kind of, having questions about their own, work culture and things like that, and asking like, hey, are we doing this right? And I'm trying to find more voices like that who are asking like, hey, there has to be a better way to do what we're doing, and make sure, yes, everyone is heard, but we also don't want to be platforming stuff that is like unbelievably dangerous, which that still seems to be happening.
Yeah, it does. But I remember one thing that I heard, and I heard it from one person, but then it just kind of kept bubbling up from lots of different outlets. But I remember last year in 2022 when kind of masking was finally falling away and we're starting to feel like, okay, like we're going to move beyond this moment in time. And we're given such an incredible opportunity right now in this moment to rethink everything.
Yeah.
And the stakes are really, really high right now, but the freedom, the threshold of freedom is really, really low right now. There's a lot of space right now to really get dirty with solutions and to question how we've done things for so long, whether that be the church or media or schools or any other sector. This is a really, really, really high reward, potentially high reward, low risk time to just put it all on the line and figure out some new things that are going to bring hopefully justice and bring to fruition a world that is a little bit more kind to the people who deserve that justice. Mm-hmm. We all deserve it, but you know, the least of these might deserve it.
Yeah.
I think Jesus said they deserve it a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? I agree 100%. I think that's really, you know, circling this conversation back around, I think that's really where hope comes into the picture.
Yeah.
We do have that low threshold right now to be able to talk about these things.
Yeah.
And so we should.
Yeah.
And yes, the stakes are high. Like the next 10 years in this country are probably going to shape the next at least 100.
Yeah.
It's going to set the course for that. And it really is important that we get as much right as we can right now to make sure that course is set as correctly as possible. Takes work, takes time, takes wading through a lot of frustration. But you know, we have several years to figure this out and get this right. And the threshold, at least to start that conversation, like you said, is very low.
Yeah.
And we should take advantage of that.
Amen. Well, Mark Hackett, thanks for being on the show. Where can we find you? Where can people listen to you and learn more about what you're doing and Operation Broken Silence? Do your plugs, all the plugs.
Yeah. So if you're interested in learning more about Sudan and what's happening there right now, you can go to our website, operationbrokensilence.org. We actually have if you want to get involved, we have a donor who's matching donations right now to all of our Sudanese partners. You know, there are obviously some urgent needs we're trying to address. Yeah. And a very generous individual stepped forward and is matching $15,000 in donations.
Okay.
That's going to help some real people who need help right now.
Yeah.
If you're interested, I guess, in my thoughts on church and life.
I am.
I also have a website. It's markhackett.com. You can read the stuff I write there and also access the Extra Words podcast.
You've even got some merch.
I do.
You've got merch.
It's sassy.
It is. Too. It's sassy. It's cool. And I think everybody's getting their... if you're getting a tax rebate, you know, right now, give a little bit to Operation Broken Silence and then spend the extra on Mark's merch store because he's got some really cool stuff on there.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah. This has been Faithfully Memphis. My name is Emily Austin. I'm with the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee. If you like what you're hearing, why don't you share our show with someone who hasn't heard it before. That really helps us to spread the word about what we're doing on Faithfully Memphis. You can like us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a positive review. We like positive reviews. And if you have any thoughts about the show or somebody you'd like to hear on the show, you can let us know in the comments there too. You can listen to all the past episodes of Faithfully Memphis on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can learn about the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee and find a church that is inclusive and loving and on our website, edwtn.org. Thanks so much for listening today. And until next time, I want you to stay safe and stay positive. Bye.